1 Samuel 26-27, the 20th talk in a series in 1 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on January 18, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 1 Samuel chapters 26 and 27. This passage presents some difficulties, at least it did for me. I spent quite a bit of time this week thinking about it, trying to figure it out, This version of my outline is just off the press, and so we'll see how it comes out, whether I solved it or not. But generally, I would like everybody here to see this as a work session. I actually think that every Sunday should be a work session. I'm going to go through and tell you what, bring you in on my thought process, but you're the one that ultimately has to resolve it for yourself. That's certainly no different today. The background for this section is that Saul is still chasing David, would like to kill David because he sees David as a threat to him, a rebel against him. And so Saul has been chasing him for some time. We don't know how long, but it's on the order of years. Samuel, the prophet, is dead at this point. And apparently, with Samuel's death, David has a little less protection from Saul. That somehow Samuel was a restraining force on Saul, and that's gone. So now Saul is expending more effort than ever trying to go after David and get him and kill him. As a result, we're going to see that David seems to be reaching a point of frustration. That David is frustrated because he doesn't understand why Saul is chasing him. David has insisted all along that he is not a rebel, and he's gone out of his way to try to demonstrate that. But Saul will believe it for a little while, but then Saul's right back on the trail and after him again. And that has been the pattern. And David, as a result of Saul's increased pressure, David's running out of options. He's not sure what to do. And frustrated because he thinks that if he could just make clear to Saul that he's not a rebel, this would all go away. But he can't seem to make that happen. This account has some similarities with an account two or three chapters earlier when Saul came into a cave where David was, and David cut off the tassels of Saul's robe and then showed them to Saul later and made the argument to Saul, I could have killed you, but because I respect you and your position, I did not. This one's going to be a similar kind of an account. Some commentaries say, well, it's actually the same event told in two different ways, and sloppy editing left them both in the text and that sort of thing. But really, I think it makes a lot of sense to see these as two different events, but there are some differences between them that are highlighted by the author, and I want to focus on those differences because by looking at those differences, we see some change in both David's perspective and in Saul's perspective that helps us understand the text as a whole. So that's what I'll be focusing on. 1 Samuel 26, the first five verses. Then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, Is not David hiding on the hill of Hakalah, which is before Jeshimon? So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having with him 3,000 chosen men of Israel, to search for David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul camped in the hill of Hakalah, which is before Jeshimon, beside the road. And David was staying in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies, and he knew that Saul was definitely coming. David then arose and came to the place where Saul had camped. And David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. And Saul was lying in the circle of the camp, and the people were camped around him. Okay, it's the Ziphites again. They were the ones who had informed on David earlier, and as a result, Saul had come down to find him. These are apparently the same ones. Earlier it said, Ziphites told Saul. Now it says, the Ziphites told Saul. Apparently it's the same group. It's the same people that are informing on David. Saul had been back at Gibeah, which served as his capital. And they tell him, they report to him in his capital, that David is in a certain area within their territory, the hill of Hakalah, which is before Jeshimon. That's the same place that he had been before. So Saul gets his army together. It's the same number of men. It's his 3,000-man army that he takes down there a second time, goes down to the wilderness of Ziph, camps there. Remember last time, Saul had wanted to have definite information before he went down. He wanted to be certain where David was and what he was doing before he would send his army down. This time, he doesn't care about the certainty. He's just headed out. He's going down. Now it's David that wants certain information. It says that David sent out spies, and he knew that Saul was definitely coming. So David's the one, he actually has definite information. Saul, in the previous account, wanted definite information, certainty. Once he knows that Saul is camped in his area, David sends out spies. He didn't do that earlier. Things are a little dicier at this point. David's a little more concerned. The pressure's a little greater. So David sends out spies to determine exactly where Saul is and what his encampment looks like, how it's fortified, etc. And what's discovered is that Saul's army is camped in this location on the hill of Hakalah, and Saul is the place where he sleeps is right in the middle, right smack dab in the middle, with his main commander, Abner, next to him. Next section. Then David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, saying, "Who will go down with me to Saul in the camp?" And Abishai said, "I will go down with you." So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping inside the circle of the camp, with his spear stuck in the ground at his head. And Abner and the people were lying around him. Then Abishai said to David, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hand. Now, therefore, please let me strike him with the spear to the ground with one stroke, and I will not strike him the second time." But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt?" David also said, "As the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, or his day will come that he dies, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But now please take the spear that is at his head and the jug of water, and let us go." So David took the spear and the jug of water from beside Saul's head, and they went away. But no one saw or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep, because a sound sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. So David sees the way that they're encamped. There's the 3,000 men are all camped around, sleeping around, and Saul and Abner are smack dab in the middle. And so David decides he's going in. It's not clear why he decides he's going to go in, whether he has this plan in advance or whether he's just going to go in and play it by ear is not clear. But he wants someone else to go with him. He asks two individuals. Apparently these are individuals that he trusts and he believes are competent. Ahimelech the Hittite is one that he asks, and Abishai is the second. Now, Abishai is the son of Zeruiah. I'm trying to remember who Zeruiah is. That's David's sister. Zeruiah is David's sister. She had three sons, Abishai, Joab, and Asahel. And Joab and Asahel will both show up in 2 Samuel. They haven't appeared yet in the text. And Abishai shows up here. So Abishai is David's nephew. He's the one that volunteers to go. David says, great. And they're the two of them then go into the camp. They sneak in the camp, winding their way through the people that are surrounding Saul, and they get into the middle of the camp where Saul is. And Abishai's response is, we made it. That means that God has given this opportunity for us to kill Saul and be done with this problem. And he says, and he knows David's scruples, I think. I mean, he's seen David try to figure out how to deal with Saul before. He knows that David's reluctant to kill Saul. But Abishai has a proposition. He says, let me run him through with a spear just once. I won't mutilate him. And you don't have to do it. I'll do it. And we'll be done with him. And David's response is, no, we aren't going to do it. Saul is going to die one of three ways. God might strike him dead someday. Let's see, what's the second option? He might die of natural causes. Or he might die at the hands of his enemies in battle, in war. But he's not going to die at the hands of those who respect him and who respect God. That's the stance that David has taken all along. He reiterates it here. So he says, we're just going to take the spear, we're going to take his jug of water, and we're leaving here. We're not going to do anything to him. The spear would have been an emblem, a symbol of his power. It's like the scepter. But here he's out at war, and the spear becomes kind of the symbol of the power that he has over the army. But it's also his and his alone. So it's also tied to him, identifies him. Apparently, by taking the spear, it's not the same as cutting off the tassels. There was something more disrespectful about cutting off those tassels than taking his spear, apparently. So he takes the spear and jug, they leave. And no one woke up. No one noticed it. There have been a number of times in the text where we have seen David's skill. And I don't think we're to underestimate here David's skill. There's skill involved in this. But in conjunction with that skill, there's also God working. When David killed Goliath, there was skill involved, but there was also God working. The two are not separable. So David gets out, no one notices. He's got the spear and the jug of water in his hands. Next section. Then David crossed over to the other side and stood on top of the mountain at a distance with a large area between them. And David called to the people and to Abner the son of Ner, saying, will you not answer, Abner? Then Abner answered and said, who are you who calls to the king? So David said to Abner, are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came to destroy the king your lord. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, all of you must surely die, because you did not guard your lord, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is, and the jug of water that was at his head. So similar to the last section, the other incident that was similar in the cave, David engages in dialogue. This time it's with Abner. It's not with Saul directly, at least at first. Later he's going to address Saul directly. But at first it's with Abner, the commander. And this time it emphasizes that there's a big distance between them. David's sense of the danger in the situation is greatly heightened. He's being more cautious. It says, then David called to the people and to Abner. David seems to be wanting to not address Saul directly. He wants to take his appeal to the people. What David had indicated earlier is that what he feared was that evil men were denouncing David, were slandering David. And apparently what he wants to do is make his appeal more public to the people themselves, the army, the soldiers themselves, and make the argument that he is indeed loyal to the king. He calls out to Abner, and what he says is, "Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel?" In other words, aren't you a star? Aren't you one of the champions of the army in Israel? And yet, you weren't able to guard your king. What accounts for your laxity? What accounts for your incompetence? He says, "For one of the people came to destroy the king, your lord." He's indicating how dangerous the situation was. Somebody could have killed the king on his watch, on Abner's watch. "This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, all of you must surely die because you did not guard your Lord, the Lord's anointed." Here they had in their midst the Lord's anointed, and the 3,000 of them, and in particular Abner, were not able to keep him protected. I think what he's implying is, because you don't care all that much. You didn't care enough to stay awake. You didn't care enough to stay alert to protect the Lord's anointed. He could have been killed. I think he's hinting that David is actually the one who respects the anointed, and they do not. So then he holds up the spear and the jug as proof that he was there, that he was right there next to the king and could have killed him had he chosen to do so. Next section. Then Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord the king." He also said, "Why then is my lord pursuing his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand? Now, therefore, please let my lord the king listen to the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it is men, cursed are they before the Lord, for they have driven me out today, that I should have no attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.' Now then, do not let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to search for a single flea, just as one hunts a partridge in the mountains." So at this point, Saul jumps into the conversation. It's been a rather one-sided conversation so far. Abner didn't respond to David. Abner was obviously embarrassed. But Saul jumps in, and Saul addresses David as my son David, indicating a respectful kind of address, indicating that David is his is one under his authority. And David responds in like fashion, also respectfully. He refers to Saul as his lord, the king. And then he reiterates the question that he's had all along, and that is, why are you pursuing me? What is this all about? Why do you keep having your suspicions with respect to me? He says, what have I done? Or what evil is in my hand? And we'll talk about this more, but David has obviously done soul searching and is convinced that he has done nothing wrong. Then he goes, this is the section that I have had difficulty with, but this is how I can, the best that I can put this together. He gives Saul two options as to what could be happening. Why is Saul pursuing him? One possibility is that it is at the Lord's prompting that Saul is pursuing him, that the Lord has stirred him up against David. And presumably, in this case, God would be doing that because Saul is serving as an instrument of God's justice. Saul is pursuing David because David has done something wrong. And that if that's the case, then the solution is for David to repent, for David to give offerings to God. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that it isn't at God's stirring that Saul is pursuing David, but it's at the stirring of other men. That there are men who are inciting Saul to chase after David. And if that is the case, we aren't talking about righteous men doing this. We're talking about wicked men doing this. That they are slandering David. And if that's the case, David is saying, may they be cursed. Because they are stirring up Saul to chase after a righteous man. And if that's what's happened, then it is putting David in a position where he is being driven away from Israel. And I think he means that geographically, very literally. David's concern seems to be, well, we've noticed that David has gone several places to escape from Saul. He's gone in various places in the wilderness of Judea. But he's also gone outside of Judah. He went to Moab for a period of time. But as you'll recall, the prophet God spoke to him, and said, go back. You can't stay here. So he didn't stay in Moab very long. We also know that he went down to the wilderness of Paran, which would have been south of where Israel's located. We don't know why he came back, but we know that he came back from there as well. Apparently, when he leaves Judah, God moves him to return. God won't let him stay in areas outside of Judah. David is really attracted. He wants to stay in the land of Judah, the land that is God's. It is the land that God had given to the Israelites. In solidarity with his people and with God, he wants to remain in Israel. He feels that that's important. But now he's in a situation where, as Saul continues to apply a pressure to him, seek after him even more diligently, David's running out of places to go. And he's put in a position where the only place left for him to go is to go into the land of the Philistines. He doesn't want to do that, but that seems to be his only option. And it's interesting, he says, for they have driven me out today that I should have no attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. And I think what he's indicating here is to go into the land of the Philistines, if that's where he goes, there will be a certain amount of accommodation to Philistine culture that he will be forced to do. So to tell him to go into to Philistia is like telling him to go serve other gods. And David doesn't want to do that. He says, "Now then, do not let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord." He doesn't want to leave Israel and die elsewhere. He wants to maintain that solidarity with God, God's land, and God's people. Then he gives a second reason why Saul shouldn't be chasing after him, and that is, why me? I'm not all that significant. I'm like a flea. It's like one hunts a partridge in the mountains. The word for partridge is one that calls, and earlier in the passage, David had called out to Abner. Next section. Then Saul said, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will not harm you again, because my life was precious in your sight this day. Behold, I have played the fool and have committed a serious error." And David answered and said, "Behold the spear of the king. Now let one of the young men come over and take it, and the Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I refuse to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Now behold, as your life was highly valued in my sight this day, so may my life be highly valued in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me from all distress." Then Saul said to David, "Blessed are you, my son David. You will both accomplish much and surely prevail." So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. Once again, Saul admits that he is in the wrong, just as he had after the cave incident. He says, "I've done wrong. I will not harm you again, because my life was precious in your sight this day." So Saul is saying, "I did wrong. You're safe. I will not harm you again." David doesn't believe a word of it. And nor should he. What Saul says here is less contrite than what he had said before. And the contrition that he had expressed before was obviously very short-lived. There's no reason to think that it would be longer lasting here. So David does not run over and give him a hug. David says, "You can have your spear back. Send a single soldier over. I will give it to that single soldier and he can take it back." David is taking no risks. He's not taking it over there. He's having one soldier come and pick it up, take it back. And you can see in what David says here, he's basically given up trying to convince Saul that there is not a rebellious bone in his body. He's given that up. It's falling on deaf ears. And now he's making this shift. He realizes that his fate is in the hands of God and God alone. And that's where he's going to rest. That's where he has to rest, because Saul is not going to change his mind. He makes the statement, "And the Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness." And I think he has Saul in mind here, that people, both you and I, Saul, are both going to be paid according to our righteousness and our faithfulness. And he knows that Saul will not measure up well there. And David is confident, and I think on the basis of a lot of soul searching, that he, David, can say that in good conscience. He has been righteous and faithful in all of this. God delivered Saul into David's hands, but David did not kill him because of his respect for God primarily, but also for Saul. And then David says in 24, "Now behold, as your life was highly valued in my sight today," in other words, as I respected you out of respect for God, so may my life be highly valued in the sight of God. May God then recognize my heart and treat me appropriately because of that, and deliver me from all distress. Saul responds. Again, it's a blessing, but it's a faint blessing. It's less complete than what he had said earlier. He just says, "Blessed are you, my son David. You will both accomplish much and surely prevail." And then it says, David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. Last time it said that Saul returned to his, I can't remember, I think his back home. Here Saul just goes back to his place, and David goes on his way. There's less of a separation here than it happened even before. So you can kind of sense David's despair with respect to finding a way to right things with Saul. That's not going to happen. And David's convinced that if he stays in Judea, he will die. Chapter 27, verse 7 verses. "Then David said to himself, 'Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Saul then will despair of searching for me any more in all the territory of Israel, and I will escape from his hand.' So David arose and crossed over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Maok, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each with his household, even David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. Now it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he no longer searched for him. Then David said to Achish, 'If now I have found favor in your sight, let them give me a place in one of the cities in the country, that I may live there. For why should your servant live in the royal city with you?' So Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. And the number of days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. So David sees no other option. Anytime he goes outside of Judah in another direction, he seems to be directed back to Judah by God. God won't let him stay in those places. And those would be safer. Moab probably would be the safest. But God won't let him stay in the safest place. He only sees one option that is still open to him, and that option is to go into Philistia. He's going to live there. So that's where he goes. He takes all of his men, the 600 men, all of them move there with their families. So this is they're making a big commitment here. Saul gives up. Saul decides he can't go into Philistia and get David. And I suspect that Saul's also thinking, if David has gone over to the Philistines, David is no longer a threat to take the throne. Because if he has sided with the Philistines, Israel will not follow him. David goes to Gath. That is the same place where he had been earlier when he first started to flee from Saul. Remember, he went there, but people recognized him. He realized he was in danger, so he acted like he was crazy and was able to leave without being taken captive. This is the same city that he's going back to. It's not clear whether this is the same king. It says that it's Achish, but Achish is a very common name in Philistia. And I mean, it shows up on pottery sherds and there are other places. So it has been found quite frequently in the Philistine territory. So scholars suspect that Achish is a term like in Philistia, like Pharaoh is a term in Egypt that refers to the one who is the king. And that could be why it goes on to identify this Achish as the son of Maach, more specifically. So this could be a different person than he had encountered earlier. It's not clear. So he moves into Philistia. But David says to Achish, he says, give me a city. It's too crowded here in the capital. It's too crowded here in Gath. So give me a city where I can support myself. I don't have to rely on what you provide for me and my men. If you just give me a city, I can take care of myself. And so he, Achish, decides that's a good idea and gives him the city of Ziklag. Interestingly, in verse 6 it says, so Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. It says the kings of Judah, indicating that this seems to have been written after the division of the kingdom into the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah. And it's more than one king into the divided kingdom, because it's saying the kings of Judah. So apparently, 1 Samuel was either written in the period of the divided kingdom, or at the very least edited at the time of the divided kingdom. And it points out that David lived in the country of the Philistines a year and 4 months. That's how long he was in Philistia. We know that he was running around in the Judean desert for a long period of time. It's not clear how long. But this is all adding up to years that David is running from Saul. Okay. The last section. Now David and his men went up and raided the Girgashites and the Girzites and the Amalekites, for they were the inhabitants of the land from ancient times, as you go to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. And David attacked the land and did not leave a man or a woman alive. And he took away the sheep, the cattle, the donkeys, the camels, and the clothing. Then he returned and came to Achish. Now Achish said, where have you made a raid today? And David said, against the Negev of Judah and against the Negev of the Jeramelites and against the Negev of the Kenites. And David did not leave a man or a woman alive to bring to Gath, saying, lest they should tell about us, saying, so has David done, and so has been his practice all the time he has lived in the country of the Philistines. So Achish believed David, saying, he has surely made himself odious among his people Israel. Therefore, he will become my servant forever. So, in order to keep himself and his men fed and clothed to provide for themselves. They're soldiers at this point. They're fighters. And their occupation is fighting. So David goes out on raids. That's the way they earn their living. And it would appear that he is obligated to give Achish some of what he plunders. So David is going out and raiding villages, collecting plunder, and he takes some of that and gives it to Achish. paying his taxes. Where does he go raiding? He goes raiding into the Negev. The tribes that are listed that he goes raiding against appear to be Canaanite tribes. So they aren't Philistine tribes, and they aren't Israelite tribes. They're Canaanites, people who had been there from the time before the Israelites entered into the promised land. He raids them and kills them, every man and woman. And apparently, he's acting in accordance with the instructions that had been given by Joshua. When the Israelites first came into the land, they were to kill the Israelites, every man, woman, and child. David's doing the same thing here. He's got a different reason. Well, he's got an additional reason, maybe. The additional reason is he wants none of them to escape, because he doesn't want word to get back to Achish that he is raiding only Canaanite villages. He doesn't want Achish to understand where this plunder is coming from. When Achish asks him where he's been, he answers it evasively. He answers in a way that leads Achish to misunderstand what David has been doing. He says that he has gone against the Negev of Judah and the Negev of Jeremelites and the Negev of the Kenites. All of those would have been either Israelites or allies of Israel. Well, he has gone into the Negev, but he hasn't gone against the villages of the peoples that he has indicated here. So David has been, his answer is calculated to be deceptive. And Achish believes him, and Achish feels confident then that David is, by the circumstances, going to have to be loyal to him, Achish, for the rest of his life. That he's in a position of servitude to Achish, and he will have no option. There's no way that he can go back to Israel. Okay. There are a couple of things that I want to comment on. Clearly, the picture that it's emerging here is Saul is becoming more and more hardened. It is becoming clear to David that reconciliation is not a possibility. Saul will not be dissuaded. Saul is intent on getting David if he can and killing him. And Samuel now is out of the picture. There's no one to be a buffer between him and Saul. David feels this increased pressure, and therefore sees his options as being greatly limited. And he's frustrated and doesn't know exactly how to deal with that. And this last incident, rather than improving the situation, has just convinced David that he had no option but to go into Philistia, flee there, and find sanctuary there. As I try to think about what's going on in David's mind, he was obviously very perplexed, and you can imagine his perplexity. David has been anointed by Samuel. David has been told on two different occasions by Jonathan that he will become the king of Israel. And I think that David has come to accept that is what's going to happen. It just has to happen according to God's principles. David is not going to take steps to kill Saul and eliminate him so that David can claim the throne. That throne is going to have to be presented to David by God rather than David grasping it. David has had a number of incidents that have occurred that show God's hand on David. If you remember back to the story of Goliath, God's hand was on David there. David was successful because God had had blessed him and made that possible. The killing of the Philistines, he was asked by Saul that he had to kill, 200 Philistines in order to marry Saul's daughter. And David went out and did that. Saul gave him that assignment because Saul assumed that he could not return from that assignment alive. David did return alive. So there are a number of things that happened in Saul, in David's rise to prominence, which were obviously God's doing. So Saul, as David looks at his life, he can see, I was anointed. I've been told that I will be the king of Israel. God's been working in circumstances and bringing me to a position of prominence within Israel. Everything seems to be going well. And then Saul turns against him and David has to flee. And David's confusion is, I didn't do anything wrong. And he must have done a lot of soul searching to try to sort out, am I missing something? Did I do something that I'm not aware of? And I think what we're seeing when we get into these two chapters is after all of that soul searching, and that soul searching has probably lasted years, really, he's convinced that he did not do anything wrong. There was not a bit of rebelliousness in him. And that what is actually happening is evil men have instigated Saul against him. And David never pins the blame on Saul. I think the author of 1 Samuel is actually locating much of the blame in Saul himself. But it is probably also true that there are men that are encouraging Saul in that direction. And that is something that David can't do anything about. So David makes this shift where he is placing his trust in God. He knows that he is blameless in this situation. God's the one that's going to have to pull him through. And he sees himself as having only one option, go to Philistia, a place where he desperately does not want to go. But that seems to be the only option. And he seems to have the perspective, I'll go there, God help me. Because that is going to be a dicey situation. And he decides to deal with it as best he can. He'll take it as it comes and figure things out as he goes along. Obviously, this has created a lot of angst in David over this period of time. And he's in a very difficult situation. The other thing I feel obligated to talk about is David's misleading statements with respect to Achish. He did not technically lie. So there's a sense in which you can say that he didn't lie. I don't like that explanation. It was calculated to be misleading. It was misleading. It was the equivalent of a lie. Then the question is this wrong? Are we to see David as doing wrong here? And I think that's a very difficult one. I am convinced that there are times when lying is not wrong. There's the question, the ethical question of, what do you do when the Nazi soldiers come to your door? You're hiding Jews in your house. And they ask you the question, are you hiding Jews in your house? Do you say yes or do you say no? If you say yes, you send them to their death. I think in those kinds of situations that it is probably justifiable to lie. I think there are two or three places in the Old Testament, in the narratives, where lies are told, and the text seems to be approving of them. So I'm convinced that it is sometimes justified to lie. When is that justified? That is difficult for me. It's not crystal clear to me what characterized those situations where lying is justified. I mentioned last week in the situation with Abigail where she acted in contrary to the way that her husband had acted with respect to David, without his permission. And yet, I think that what we're to see in that text was a heart of submission in Abigail, even though she did something contrary to what her husband had done with respect to David. And I said last week that those ethical kinds of issues are very difficult, and God has left us in that difficult realm with respect to ethics. I think the same is true with respect to lying. That we are to value truth and be defenders of truth. That's important. But there are times when it is justifiable to make statements that are misleading and technically contrary to what is true. I have, over the years, as I have thought about this more and more, I've become convinced that biblical morality is a set of guidelines to be followed rather than rules. It's not the kind of situation where you say, under these circumstances, if we can tell but from this verse and this verse and this verse that it adds up to this particular action. That figuring out what to do ethically in any situation is an art rather than a calculation. And it's a matter of staying within the spirit of the guidelines that God has given us. And that's a tough place to be. In many respects, I'd rather have the calculation. But that doesn't seem to be what God has set out for us. It's an art instead. And that's what wisdom is, that art. Many years ago, I helped build a house for my parents. They had an architect draw the drawings for it. We came to a situation where on one page it was directing us to do one thing, and on another page it was describing the house differently, and they were incompatible. And we took it to the architect, and the architect said, "Oh, you work that out in the field." I think what that meant was, I don't know the answer. With respect to the Bible, I don't think that's quite the case. God does know the answer, but that phrase, "work it out in the field," is one that I have thought mentally very often. That seems to be the task that God has given us. That we've been given this task of working in a world that's complex and complicated. We haven't been given all the answers. We've just been given the principles by which we need to live our lives. And there is something valuable about having to reflect on what those principles are. How would they come to bear on this particular set of circumstances? And do I care? And it's that last one, I think, that keeps being thrown in our face. Do I care to do that which is right? And having to work it out raises that issue in a way that the calculations never would. And that seems to be what God is trying to accomplish. Okay. Comments, questions, answers?
So it's okay to lie to my spouse about what gift I might be giving her for Christmas?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The question I have is, with the Philistines, can you kind of sort that out in terms of, here's David who's killed Goliath and killed all these Philistines, and how in the world can they allow this man to come in and have shelter in their country?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not unprecedented in history to have someone fighting for his country, his people, and someplace in the midst of that conflict turn sides. There are a number of examples of that happening. And I think, but in this particular circumstance, I think the Philistines know that David is in a different situation now than he had been in when he killed Goliath. When he killed Goliath, he was a rising star and had a lot of potential in Israel. At this juncture, Saul hates him. Saul wants to kill him. And as David sees it, there's no real potential for him to rise up to a position of prominence. I think the Philistines know that. They understand what a situation David has been put into. They can understand his desperation, and they think they can use that to their advantage. Having him as a warrior on their side is a great advantage. And that seems to be what they're wanting to do. They want to turn him.
I wanted to make a comment about David's interaction with Abner and the 3,000 soldiers. Presumably, the Lord's anointed in that time would appear to the people as being someone who is invincible, in that the Lord is on their side, and so nobody could touch them unless the Lord let them touch them. Mm-hmm. And David's interaction with Abner seems to be saying, listen, you know, presumably, the enemies of the Lord's anointed have limited access to him. And however, you know, me and my young nephew came in there, took his Glock and his thermos, and we're out here unharmed, mm-hmm. you know, in the midst of 3,000 men. And yet your king is kind of left bare and open. And isn't he kind of communicating to Abner and the men, hey, you're guarding the wrong guy? I'm the anointed one. Look at how God has protected me, and look at how the king is left unprotected. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't that tell you something?
Mm-hmm. I'm putting it together a little differently in that I don't think that the Israelites would have seen the anointed as being invincible. And that's why he's in the middle of the men. It's their job to protect him, actually. So I think that they see that as, it is a possibility that Saul would be killed. So what David is highlighting is, he's the anointed, he's in their midst, but how much do they value him? How much do they respect him? If they would allow two guys to come in through all of them, no one notice, and take his spear and his jug of water. And the charge against him against David has been, he is disloyal to the anointed. And David has said all along, nothing could be further from the truth. And I think this is just another demonstration. I'm the one, David is saying, I'm the one that respects Saul. It's not you. So if that's the charge against me, the charge could even be more justly leveled at you.
I was thinking about the options that David presents Saul.
The two options.
One is, maybe I've done something wrong, but let me repent and mm-hmm. present an offering. Or the other is, it's bad, it's evil men.
Right.
It struck me that there wasn't the option of what Saul's actually doing.
Right.
And David continues to, even in the back in the cave and here, provide Saul with perspective from God, well, God's perspective about what's true about David.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Saul continues consistently to, in the short term he says okay, but in the long term he says he doesn't go with it.
Right.
And that seems to be a theme.
Right. David never accuses Saul. Right. David is very, he gives Saul the benefit of the doubt. But I think it is true that part of what David is doing is giving Saul food for thought to reflect upon himself. That seems to be, I think that's what's happening throughout, actually. But he's giving Saul the benefit of the doubt. Right, right. Yes?
I'm following up on that a bit because I had a similar question. It's interesting to me that David doesn't speak the truth to Saul directly. And maybe just as Larry is saying, Randy, you know, that is it, in a sense, his strategy and perhaps wisdom based on this reflection, but is it his strategy to approach Saul indirectly such that Saul himself, giving Saul the chance to come around, whether or not he's confident Saul even would, but I guess on the other side I would ask why, or simply comment that it is interesting that he's not just speaking plainly to Saul, and perhaps, I guess I am asking to myself, why does he take this indirect route rather than simply saying, Saul, you have no basis upon which to come after me?
Right. I don't know, but I my guess would be it's a combination of two things. One is I think he wants to show respect to Saul. So he wants to give him the benefit of the doubt, at least publicly. And the second is, what Saul really needs to do is reflect. And an accusation is not going to do that any better than just laying stuff out the way he has. And I suspect that's part of what he's doing as well. And there's nothing that he can do to force Saul to reflect. All he can do is give Saul the opportunity. That's what he's doing.
This sounds like a travelogue. If you read, I mean, it's like these guys going hither and yon. They're north, they're south, east, west. Militarily, it seems to me that David's pretty aware that Saul is gathering up the cream of the crop of Israeli manhood and dragging them all over the place, exposing the frontier to anyone who wants to penetrate it.
Right.
And Saul's not content to just run David off. He wants him dead.
He wants him dead.
And David has to be sitting up there when Saul says, oh, we're friends, come on down. David says, no, man, you're nuts. You're obsessive. You're willing to sacrifice the safety of the people to pursue this vendetta against me. I'm not coming down off this hill.
Right.
So there's much of this narrative which is just narrative. It's just kind of like, okay, David wasn't completely truthful with this guy. It's not the point. I mean, it's like, what would you say? We went out and did a little raiding. So didn't get much, though, so we'll go out another time. I mean, it just seems that the writer of this is painting this picture of the failure of Saul. The self-indulgence and the personal obsession with, there's one guy out there that doesn't like me. There's one guy out there that's a challenge. He's like, it's like Al Capone or something. And David's been anointed by Samuel a long time ago. And, I mean, David could just retreat somewhere and wait. But he stays on the periphery, and he is sort of a burr in his, a thorn in his side. And, I don't know, it just seems to me it's very rich. There's a lot of it that we now can't really grasp because we weren't there. Observation.
Right, right. It is, I think you're right that there is a sense in which the author is highlighting this, the development of Saul and his attitude towards David. It's very interesting. There's clearly a pathological element to it. But the other thing that is being developed, I think, is what's David doing, what he's thinking. That is also interesting. And I don't know that I really thought about this much before, but someone like David, where There have been things said with respect to what God is going to do in his life. I think he really believes them. But that still makes the day-to-day difficult. He still has to dodge the bullet when it's shot at him. And he's dealing with those kinds of realities and it for over a long period of time. And when Jack was teaching in Luke and talked about Jesus in Gethsemane, he knew what was going down. He knew what was going to happen. But he's still struggling mightily. And I think we're seeing the same kind of thing happening with David. It's a tough thing to sort out and figure out, okay, what do I do next? And how do I think about it?
It got answered.
Okay. Okay, thanks.